Welcome, everyone. We look like we're disorganized, but don't be fooled by that. We're very, very organized.
We are.
We know exactly what we're doing.
That's
we're
right.
just happy to have you here.
Testing.
And we're going to start forward. And as Secretary of State, Bill Bradbury, if he will come forward, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2080. And I'll ask Jim if he'll tell us a little bit about what House Bill 2080 is.
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2080 allows the governor by proclamation upon request of the Secretary of State to extend the deadline for returning ballots in the event of civil disorder, state of emergency, natural disaster, or other catastrophic events. Limits the extension of the deadline to no more than 14 calendar days after the election. Directs the governor to set deadline for returning ballots. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Welcome, Secretary Bradbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Both to you and Representative Berger, the co-chairs of this committee, and other members of this committee. I sort of feel like I'm in a coastal caucus meeting with the
I'll members, bet you do.
That makes me feel very comfortable, so it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm here to testify about House Bill 2080, which, as was just described, would allow the governor, at the request of yours truly, to extend the ballot return deadline in the case of a disaster or an emergency. An election day that is a good example of why we are seeking this authority is September 11th. Not this September 11th, but a number of probably, what, 5 years ago, five or six years ago. It's really important to remember that was September 11th was an election day in New York City. And in the middle of that terrible disaster, officials had to postpone the election, and they didn't have any legal framework to do so. But they still did it. But they didn't have any legal framework to postpone that election. Now, let me give you an example of an election day emergency that is a little bit closer to home than New York City. This past year, this last November, several areas of the state were underwater on election day. Tillamook County got hit with 13 inches of rain in 24 hours. That's a state record for rainfall in the state where it rains a lot, Oregon. Roads were being closed. Drop boxes were out of reach for voters as the floodwaters rose in Tillamook County. County Clerk Tassie O'Neill, who's here today, and her staff did a really extraordinary job managing Election Day in the middle of that natural disaster. And then in a neighboring county to Tillamook County, Clatsop County, Nicole Williams, who's also here today, and her staff did similarly great work in the face of very similar conditions in Clatsop County. And with the clock ticking down on Election Day, Tassie had the wisdom and experience to deputize local law enforcement as election workers so that they, the local law enforcement, could receive and deliver ballots for voters so that if they were able to find, get to someone's house finally and find those people, they could actually take their ballot and deliver it. Nicole arranged for the only vehicle that had a high enough clearance to get through the floodwaters to pick up ballots. And she officially designated a dump truck to pick up ballots. And that worked. But we were really lucky enough to have county clerks who could think on their feet and overcome these obstacles that were presented by the storm. But we all know that the day could come when a disaster could be so great that the clerks couldn't overcome the natural force of flooding or a volcano like we had with St. Helens in 1980, a snowstorm, an earthquake, a tsunami, which is certainly an issue that this committee is particularly aware of, or something as simple as a fire in the courthouse. The deluge on Election Day this year was really just another example of the unexpected that can interfere with our really most cherished right, which is our right to vote. Emergencies have a dramatic effect not only on citizens who are casting ballots, but also on county workers that we rely on to manage the election process. This bill would allow us to keep both our citizens and our election workers safe in the event of an emergency so that no one unnecessarily risks life or limb for their job or in order to cast a vote. That's really why I proposed this bill, and I obviously encourage you to pass it so that the governor can have the flexibility and authority to answer the needs of Oregon voters when the Secretary of State deems it necessary to extend the ballot return deadline to ensure that all Oregon voters are, in fact, enfranchised. So, thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Senator George.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming down, and I got a quick question.
Good.
I would never try to act like the Secretary of State's office is political. So let's say, for instance, some future Secretary of State gets into office who is very, very, let's just say they're a really big Republican, and they go to a county where there is a there is an overwhelming Republican majority voters, and there's some problem down there. In theory, what could happen is that a person that the governor and the Secretary of State could extend the deadline in a place like that and help one party over another. When you look at this right here, if we take, for instance, what happened in some of these counties, is there any possibility, if you extend the deadline on ballots in, say, for instance, Tillamook County or Clatsop County, how does that affect the state races that are then impacted by the collection of those ballots later than the rest of the state?
Those ballots would still be counted in the final determination of who won. The deadline for counting votes, it's 20 days to actually to come up with a final tally. And what this bill says is that you can extend the deadline for the election day no more than 13 days. So you would still be meeting the 20-day requirement to declare a winner in any race in the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any concern that you have that this could be used in a partisan way sometime in the future? I mean, that's a concern to me, because clearly certain counties are more to one party than the other, and there may be a temptation to extend deadlines in places. That's my concern.
There was some, we had this bill proposed, I think, last session, and there was some concern expressed about just having the authorities solely rest in the hands of the Secretary of State. And, it related partly to the concerns you're expressing about potential partisan abuse. And that's why this bill makes it up to the governor to basically declare the emergency, and the governor currently has the authority to declare an emergency. So it has to be requested by the Secretary of State and then ordered by the governor. And that's designed to be a kind of protection against that kind of abuse.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other? All right. Senator George?
Mr. Secretary, thank you for being here. Question I have is there... I'm trying to piece through this thing and figure out whether or not all the other ballots will be required. In other words, it's in a non-endangered area. Ballots going to come in, they're going to be counted on time, but we're going to wait for this one piece. Is that correct? Because it looks to me like you could stop or slow down the whole operation.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. So are you asking, would it affect like a statewide race or a state representative race that takes in two counties and you only have the emergency in one county? What would your question be about that?
Okay, let's say it's a November election and everybody's up and we have a disaster in Tillamook County. What I want to make sure, and I don't see it completely clearly defined, that the rest of the election will come in order, be counted, be secured, and then we're going to wait for the one county to be able to bring them in. I want to make sure that language is clear, that we're not going to have 20 days of floating ballots out here. Is it your understanding that every county that would be able to process would process, they would provide their tallies, and then that ballot would be secured?
Let me ask. Can I ask my elections director to come forward? I've learned that it's very wise when you ask such thoughtful, detailed questions to ask the true expert to come answer the question.
You'll give your name and identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. Senator George. Under those kinds of circumstances, our anticipation would be that where there is not an emergency, Election Day would continue as planned, that there would be an extended time for people to return their ballots in those areas where there is an emergency, and that the vote counts may well be delayed, release of the vote counts, until all the votes are in, so that there isn't any situation that could develop where, you know, we may have a real close race and all of a sudden there's this rush to the emergency counties to try and somehow affect the final outcome of the election.
I think that'll do it. I just want to make sure we got that on the record, that the intention is that every county that can conduct the election on time will do so. All of the ballots will be brought in, processed, and held. Voting tally will not be released until the other counties are in.
Right.
Okay. And then it will be finalized.
Right.
Okay. I'm okay with that.
All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to have both of y'all here. Grace in our meeting room today. We appreciate all you do. Madam Chair, I really wanted to speak to Senator George, but I'll do this via these men because I have the opposite concern that he has, that there could be numerous individuals from different counties that are overfishing at Tillamook, and we're really from Yamhill County, and, you know, somebody only allows, you know, Tillamook County to be late when we're all over there for the whatever we are doing, big fishing thing. And where I'm concerned, it seems to me it should be the entire state. If you're giving one area additional days, it should be the entire state, because who knows where the rest of us are. And in a tsunami or something like that, you know, we may be on some mountain, can't get home.
To escape.
Yes.
I guess I would respectfully say I disagree with you.
Okay.
In that I think an emergency clearly affects a specific area in terms of people being able to get to the county elections office and get to their drop boxes. Other people who happen to be in Tillamook County fishing should have voted before they went to Tillamook County to fish. So I don't have a whole lot of sympathy. Do you know what I mean? That's just kind of...
Write that down.
Win for next election.
I knew this was going to be a good day.
All right. Representative Shoffler.
Well...
Now help me.
Well, believe me, fishing's a priority.
Yeah, okay.
No denying that. But and I'm confident this will be used in the narrowest circumstances. Clearly, I saw it on TV, what was going on in Tillamook. It was terrible. And on the concerns I heard over here, if these folks are denied the ability to vote due to their inability to vote due to a disaster, that too could swing the election.
Right.
So there's a flip side to this too. Allowing them to vote could have a real result. It could go either way, is what I'm trying to say. So I think denying folks the ability to vote due to disaster could swing a statewide election in a way that some folks may like and not like. So it goes both ways on this one. But
right.
I do stress a narrow use of this. And I know you, man, and...
I really agree with that. And I, when I was preparing my testimony, I had some concern in terms of the story I told about Tillamook County, because the fact is that voter turnout in Tillamook County was 70%. Okay, so we did not, I mean, the reality is because of the wonderful work that the Tillamook County and Clatsop County did, they made it through that disaster without a problem, I mean, without a turnout problem. I can foresee something, I don't want to foresee something like September 11th, but I can see a volcano blowing up or whatever, where they, even their marvelous efforts couldn't, you know, achieve a high turnout election. So I think I've come to the place where I think it really makes sense to at least have the ability, with working with the governor, if there is an emergency that does prevent us from having good high turnout, mm-hmm. to extend that deadline for that specific affected area.
Mr. Lindbom.
Madam Chair, if I could add one more thing. I don't think I could sort of overstate the importance of having a legal framework for these situations. In the events that we're talking about here, if we had a calamitous kind of event where an entire section of the state was basically disenfranchised, but the rest of the state could vote, could you imagine the lawsuits, and how much time we would all spend in court trying to straighten out that situation with no sort of legal framework to deal with it? And I found the events in Tillamook and Clatsop County frightening from the standpoint of how close we came to that kind of situation. And I was very disturbed when we proposed this bill 2 years ago, and it felt like I couldn't get people in the legislature, at least the committees that dealt with it at that point, to take it seriously. We're really playing with fire here, so to speak. With Oregon so vulnerable to so many different kinds of disasters, we're just in a unique spot in the country that I think the variety of kinds of disasters here is quite remarkable, that it's going to happen. And the question is, are we going to have a legal framework in place to protect and enfranchise our voters, or are we just going to be left with a mess? And I think it would be terrific if this committee would help us get there.
But I think that, for one thing, everybody gets their share, and Oregon has been extremely lucky when you look around the other parts of the country and what has happened to them, and Oregon has just kind of plugged along without any major disaster. So I'm going to call on Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to second what Director Lindbeck has just said. And just also, the point of this is, in addition to setting the legal framework as a safety measure, a certain sheriff, and who shall remain unnamed, was out also collecting them, and there were some, in my opinion, I'm glad it was him and not me, but there were trees falling on cars on the road.
Right.
If anybody drove through there, they saw hundreds of trees, thousands of trees, big trees that fell down on the roads. And had people been on the road trying to get their ballot to town, if they could, even though they were faring by dump truck. But so it is a safety issue too, and I have to say I'm blessed with two of my county clerks here today who are very resourceful. And had they not been able to get the dump trucks out on the roads, or the sheriff's deputies deputized, we just saddle up the cows and just, you know, go off and collect them as people call them in. So it's a doable thing. That was a joke. Go ahead and laugh.
And I'm going to call on Representative Krieger, and next, Senator Larry George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several that I want to get to. The term natural disaster and catastrophic event, they're not really defined. I mean, some of us might know what that means. But maybe it's a catastrophic event and a natural disaster if I'm behind in the election and I want to have a little more time to, you know, get people out. Can you talk about defining those terms or what they're meant, or are they defined somewhere else?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, it's my understanding that these are the terms, and I may be wrong about this, but we asked about, we wanted to have terms similar to what the governor uses in declaring a disaster, so that they would be, there would be a parallel kind of situation. I'm no expert on what constitutes a catastrophic event versus a natural disaster, but we were trying to be parallel with the governor's powers on declarations of emergency.
We do have definitions, and I'm trying to think of which bill they're in, but I will ask Ken Murphy after we get some questions finished for you to come up, and he can clarify that for us. Another follow-up?
Yeah, I got several.
All right.
Here. You know, is House Bill 2080 modeled after any other election laws in the states? You talk about our events. Historically, if you go to the Midwest, and some of those states don't have vote by mail.
No.
And as a result of it, they got 6 foot of snow, and they can't get to the polling. So it does vary from year to year. How are they dealing with it? And is this modeled after anything that's trying to accommodate that somewhere else? You know, what are they doing in other states?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, everybody is struggling with this issue. September 11th was an eye-opening event in terms of what happened in New York. And other states have run into the same sort of argument that we hear about discretion given to somebody to postpone an election and wanting to write a bill that limits that discretion to make sure that somebody couldn't play political games. And my understanding is that that's been a source of concern. If you talk to your fellow legislators in other states that have grappled with this kind of issue, that they've talked about the same thing. This bill has been crafted as a way of not vesting that authority in one single state official, but spreading it out to two. And also, another thing to keep in mind is that in the election statutes, any citizen has the right to appeal a decision by the chief election officer to court. And if people feel that somebody's playing political games, they could use that avenue to try and stop it from happening. There has been an attempt in the crafting of this bill to try and insulate and be quite precise about these events, make them parallel to the governor's natural disaster declarations. Nobody here wants to open the door to playing political games with elections, obviously, but we think it's important to make sure that our voters are fully enfranchised in case of a natural disaster.
Follow up?
I want to make sure they aren't disenfranchised and that the process doesn't lead to any type of mischief
that
we don't foresee now.
Yeah.
And out of that would come a lack of public confidence in the voting system, which people walk away, it doesn't matter if I vote or not, you know, attitude. Just one other question here. During this 14 days, I don't know about the rest of you, but I've had all the calls at my house that I want and campaign literature come. That would be allowed to continue for another 14 days? Because that's going to probably get me to know.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, there isn't anything in this bill that would stop people from continuing to campaign if they were bound and determined to do it. I guess my comment would be that if you're in the middle of some sort of natural disaster, and it would certainly have to be a serious one in order for this to be invoked, it would be a little tough to get out there and campaign in the midst of the mess.
Doesn't know us very well.
but I don't know of a way to stop that. I also just want to make sure that it doesn't say that it would be 14 days in every case.
No.
It may not be necessary for it to be the full 14 days. It says it would be no more than 14 days.
I would feel comfortable if that were shrunk down with some reasonable time. Even talk about our flooding events, even whether it be the Lamb or even the Columbia. You got about a week there, and those waters drop, floods drop. I can't imagine having a need for 14 days. Now, if you got out to what needs 14 days, that's from the end of the election cycle. And they've already had their ballots in Oregon for 3 weeks or so, which is more generous than any other state, and you ended up with a 70% of the vote in that county. I think that says that we probably don't need a 14-day extension.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, if I could.
Right.
And based on the conversations, I think we may be able to deal with the political issue here. It seems like to me that every race that's affected by this, that perhaps what would work best is if you actually invoke this, which should be used in a very, very rare way. I mean, it should rarely, if ever, be used. That any race that's affected by one of these proclamations or decisions, that no county clerk in the entire state can release results on that race.
Right.
So, like for instance, if it was in Tillamook County, we decided that we're going to stop it. The governor's race would have been affected, which means the entire state, every county clerk, would have been prohibited from releasing the governor's. Well, there would be an immense amount of political pressure by the rest of the state to get this wrapped up quickly, so they knew who was the governor. But once you release some results in Multnomah County and Jackson County, these other places, then the political pressure would be, oh my goodness, we really need to get our activists into Tillamook County because it's close. I think if we put a deadline, or put a ban of releasing any of the results affected by this, that might help out. Do you agree?
That's our intent, and if you wanted to include that in the bill, that would be fine.
If I could.
All right.
One more. The other thing I'm having a little bit of a difficult time looking at implementation. In line 7, the governor may extend the deadline for returning ballots in a state, county, city, or district election. And then in line 10, it talks about the affected county clerks. When you guys declare this emergency, will it be for a specific county, and should we write it that way rather than declaring for a specific election? Because it seems like to me if you had an emergency in Tillamook County, it would be every single race in Tillamook County,
mm-hmm.
not just one race. So you wouldn't. It didn't seem like to me logically you'd write this mm-hmm. for the election in a state, county, city, or district election. Instead, you'd say any particular county. And I'm not sure if that was just a drafting or how we do it, but it seems like to me it makes more sense to do it by county
mm-hmm.
rather than by the race, because then you go down in line 10 and it's back to the counties. I don't know if that's helpful.
Thomas?
Yeah, we'd be happy to work with you on that. I think our intent is the same.
Yeah, I think it is just more clear, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I mean, that should say that.
Okay.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just feel like I need to make a comment here. I'm perfectly happy with the bill just the way it's drafted, and I really think it addresses the concerns that I've heard. It states clearly after consultation with affected county clerks. I mean, natural disasters don't follow county lines. And I think that it's important that we recognize that we need to talk to the people that are impacted. And the declaration of an emergency under ORS 401.055 that's delineated in this legislation is really very clear as to what the process is for designating an emergency in any given jurisdiction, which happens to be counties that generally fall into that. So I've been listening carefully to the concerns that are raised, and I really think that they're already addressed in the bill. And
all right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here. And I'm going to call on our next two presenters, Nicole Williams and Cassie O'Neill. Those who got nice kudos from Secretary of State.
Senator Berger. May I just, as they get settled, welcome both Tassie and Nicole, both of my constituents, both county clerks, and additionally very resourceful, and you're just great, you guys. Thank you. Thanks for being here today.
That won't get you any additional votes.
All right. if you will, whichever one of you is going to start, please give your name and identify yourself for the record.
Chair Berger, Chair Boone, and members of the committee, my name is Nicole Williams. I'm the Clatsop County Clerk, and I'm also the Elections Legislative Chair for the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Today, I am here to speak in support of House Bill 2080 on behalf of the association and tell you some specific problems my county faced in the November gubernatorial election. As you heard from the Secretary, last November, the North Coast had severe weather, mainly in the form of high winds and rain, which caused several areas in our county to flood. On the Monday prior to Election Day and on Election Day, we had roads closed, including Highway 101, which is just south of the city of Seaside between Seaside and Cannon Beach, and really the only main access road between the two cities. On Monday, November 6th, Clatsop County had a 47% voter turnout, which meant we anticipated approximately 6,000 more ballots to be returned to meet our projected voter turnout of 72%. And because these voters waited until the last days of the election, which we are seeing as a trend in many statewide elections, voters had to reach a drop site to return their ballots to be counted. In some cases, I can tell you that simply did not happen. I personally spoke to many voters who could not make it to a drop site to return their ballot because of the flooding. I can tell you that our county, in conjunction with the Secretary of State's office, did everything possible to make sure that these ballots would be returned. On Monday, we contacted local media to get the word out to our South County residents primarily that would have went to the Seaside drop site to drop their ballots normally, and we tried to get them to go to the City of Cannon Beach drop site. We also sent the sheriff's deputies, and we did send out our sheriff himself to retrieve these ballots from residents that cannot make it out of their homes. On election night, we sent a public works dump truck, as the secretary told you, which met the weight requirement that was allowed to travel through that Highway 101 flooding. I am very proud of the steps that we took as a county to make sure that every vote possible would count. However, if we had had the provision in law to delay the postponing of the deadline to return election ballots, we could have strongly considered this option to ensure that all ballots possible would be returned and counted. Thank you for your time today, and I think Tassie also has some things
to add. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Tassie?
Thank you, Chairman Boone and Berger and fellow committee members. My name is Tassie O'Neill. I'm the Tillamook County Clerk, and I want to thank you very much for allowing us to be here today and speak on House Bill 2080 and for your time. Due to the floods in Tillamook County around the November election this last 2006, I was in direct contact with the County Clerk's Office, Patty McGuire and Brenda Bays, and the media, our county commissioners, the sheriff's department. We also held a meeting which two of you that are sitting here today were in attendance, Representative Boone and Senator Johnson, on a phone conference call that called us all to talk about our emergency that we were having. It included 911, fire departments. We had a representative on the phone from the governor's office, and several other people within in the room that were important to this process. When I spoke at this meeting, we wanted to talk about the voter needs that there were and what we needed to do to help the voters get their ballots in. In doing that, we decided that we needed to swear in our state troopers, the sheriff's department, and city deputies. And this was all in conjunction with talking with the Secretary of State's office and doing this. And anyone who could get their ballot to those deputies or to the drop sites were counted for that election. I feel like in Tillamook County, there weren't very many people that I feel did not get to vote, and I'm very proud of that.
Great.
And we ended up with a 71.5% turnout.
All right.
And so that was great. I believe that, thank goodness, we have vote by mail in Oregon, or this really could have been something of a catastrophe, as we're talking about. We did have some other weather issues closer to the election where we had power outages for several days. Now, if that had happened, I'm not sure how we would deal with that. And so this bill would definitely help us to get through that if we needed to. And it is a small margin where we would even really like to use this, as Representative Schaffler said. I felt it was a great success, and if you have questions for us, and once again, thank you very much for having us speak today.
Thank you very much for both of you coming. Do you have questions, Senator Johnson?
No, Madam Chair, but by comparison, I'll look like a weasel if I don't welcome and acknowledge my two county clerks.
Madam Chair, I'd like to welcome them here, too.
Madam Chair, being I'm from Clatsop County originally.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. I didn't want to be left out. No, I'm so proud of both of y'all. That's awesome, what you've done. What happens when the ballots are destroyed? I mean, I see this vast volume of a tsunami coming in and the actual ballots that were to be counted that are in are ruined. What do we do in those cases? I was trying to find it here in the statutes, but I should ask Mr. Lindeck. I don't know that answer.
Chair Berger, Representative Nelson, and members of the committee, good question. We haven't had that in the state, luckily, but the county clerks are very resourceful people. And as I'm sure you are all aware, and we would have to consult with the Secretary of State's office and develop a plan. If the ballots were indeed destroyed, I would believe that we would have grounds to have to reconduct the election. So.
Chair Boone and Berger and fellow committee members and Representative Nelson, actually in our county, we did have some ballots that got quite wet. And so being resourceful, we took those ballots, we laid them out on the floor, we got fans going on them to dry them out, and not opening them prior to them drying out was what we did. And I was amazed by when we did open them up, and we were able to run the majority of those through our ballot counting machine. Otherwise, we duplicated them onto ballots that would go through.
So, Madam Chair, I'm glad you're that resourceful. So for those whose ballots no longer would count, do you then contact them that they have 14 days with which to, I mean, if we were under this plan, under which time to come get a duplicate ballot, or what would we do?
Senator Chair and Berger and the fellow committees and Representative Nelson, that would be something that we would need to work out the details with the Secretary of State's office on the best procedures that we could do. We have not had that happen up to this point.
All right. I'm going to thank you for coming. And in the essence of time, I would like to ask the director, would you like to make some comment about what would happen if all the ballots were destroyed?
Mm-hmm. All right.
John Lindback from the Secretary of State's office. Chair Berger and Representative Nelson, I think your questions point to the problem that we have when we have no legal framework in which to deal with emergencies. And we don't have anything that we can point to in statute that would tell us what to do in those kinds of cases, and we would be left in a situation like they were in New York, where you just do the best you can and try to be fair to the voters and, you know, do whatever you have to do in order to make sure that everybody is enfranchised to the best of your abilities. And so thank you for the questions, because I think they point to the problem.
All right, I'm going to ask you all to step back, and I'm going to ask Director Murphy if he will come forward and probably not just read the ORS. I think everybody can do that. But if you would just tell us in general, for the benefit of the committee, some of the parameters that we talked about and the seriousness of the event that we're looking at.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Berger and Boone, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management. And before I start, I left a little public relations pamphlet in your area talking about some success stories in Elevation in Tillamook and Nehalem. The current statute is ORS 401 that covers the majority of the language dealing with emergency management, emergency services during a disaster. And during the Joint Interim Committee, we did deal with, to some extent, trying to add some definition to what the word disaster or the word catastrophic meant or emergency. And I won't read this. There's a couple new pieces in House Bill 2370 that does talk about the circumstance, but it doesn't get into any detail, because you can well imagine you can debate that for a long time. If it's 100 homes destroyed, 101, if it's 10 people lost their life, or 11. But we talked about the different aspects of it to some extent, and it really got down to the loss of life, injury to a person or property, human suffering, or financial loss. Now, in the discussion that you had with the folks from the Secretary of State's office and those kind of things, I just want to add that a governor's declaration can only be for those areas damaged, and it's usually, not usually, it's always a county. We can't separate it by any unique lines or anything like that. But the rest of the language in ORS 401 has been there, I can personally attest, almost 7 years, and quite sure I could show you that it's been in there at least for 10, if not 20 years, with hardly any changes. The most recent change to the ORS was in 2001 when the state of Oregon agreed to sign on to the Nationwide Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which provides mutual aid with all the states in the country. So there is some definition in House Bill 2370. It's actually on page 4 and 5 for your reading at a later time, but it doesn't get down into finite details.
All right. Thank you very much, Director Murphy. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2080 and hope that Senator George and those of you who have some concerns and sounds to me like the Secretary of State's office is very well willing to work with the bill so that those areas of concern can be addressed and everybody will feel comfortable. All right, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2370, and I'll ask Jim to tell us about that.
Thank you, ma'am. House Bill 2370, we first heard this bill on January 30th. It creates the Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Oregon Military Department, abolishes the Office of Emergency Management, and transfers the function to the Office of Homeland Security and Management, declares an emergency effective on passage, and this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And I've also supplied the committee with -2 amendments to the bill.
All right. All of you have seen the -2 amendments. Those amendments were brought because of the concern of people taking away guns from people who lawfully have the right to own them. And we have those -2s. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Krieger.
I'd like to move House Bill 2370 be amended with the -2 amendments.
Representative Krieger moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2370. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move House Bill 2370 to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2370 to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass as amended recommendation. Any further discussion? The assistant will call the roll.
Senator George L.
Aye.
Senator Johnson. Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Chalkler. Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Vice Chair George Key.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Boone.
Aye.
Co-Chair Berger.
Aye. Senator Johnson has just come in. We're having the vote.
No, I wasn't up getting amendments.
We're having the vote.
Aye. Whatever the bill is, it's got to be a great thing. So much as like,
thank you, Senator Johnson.
All
right.
Raising some taxes. You guys amended it to make it shorter.
Good. Well, we can get into it.
I would never have thought that.
All right. The motion carries. The work session is closed.
Keep your gun.
And it goes to Ways and Means, so we don't need a carrier. All right. I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2369. This committee is we are hearing the House bill version of the 911 sunset. The bill with the sunset in it is what the committee was the most comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than amending the Senate bill, we have brought the House bill. And I'll call Jenny Lang.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the Joint Committee.
You got us all in.
I think I did. Thank you for, my name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest, and I did not take the opportunity to testify when you had the Senate bill in front of you, but I did want to just take a minute today to let you know that my company, in all of its various iterations over the decades, from Pacific Northwest Bell to U.S. West to now Quest, has been a firm and dedicated supporter of the 911 system. And we were involved from the get-go in figuring out how to put the charge on the bill for our customers to pay for 911 services in the counties in Oregon, and we are very proud of the work that they do and our part in that. So I wanted to let you know that we are delighted that we continue to be able to work with the 911 providers as well as our customers to make sure that that funding is available for the programs. We are happy at the same time that there is some kind of a sunset provision that continues, and are very supportive of the House version, partly because of the trust relationship that we have with our customer base. And if we are collecting money, which is then being turned over to government jurisdictions to provide services, we think that there is value in having people come to the legislature periodically, have a look at how the money is being spent, what kinds of programs are offered, and ensuring that that trust relationship that we have with our customers as we collect the money is kept in balance. So we appreciate the work that you're doing here, and firmly support House Bill 2369. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Lang, I understand the trust relationship. I mean, intellectually, I get your argument, but I had been moved by some of the testimony from the last meeting about getting rid of the sunset, and one of the reasons was that this seems to become a political balloon every session. If it was as simple as you say about coming in and reviewing the trust relationship, that would I would perhaps feel differently about it, but it seems as though periodically we have this battle about taking 911 money and why it becomes so controversial, and maybe you can help me understand something that I'm missing.
Madam Chairs and Senator Johnson, I agree with you that it has become a battleground of sorts over the last years, and I'm not sure that I understand exactly why that happens either. On the flip side, one of the things that has concerned us is, in fact, the notion that the money isn't as sacred as we have always thought it to be, and that we sort of guarantee our customers when we put it on the bill that it's going to be, that it in fact is a fund that has been raided periodically, and that makes us uncomfortable to not have a way for you to have to look at it now and then. And, you know, granted, the fact that you have that opportunity also provides an opportunity for people to say, oh, there's a few tens of hundreds of thousands or some millions of dollars that maybe we could be doing something different with. So I appreciate what you're saying as well. I'm not sure there's a perfect answer.
A joking response. I guess the trust relationship about looking what gets added to the bills. I'd love to have that option to see what gets added to my phone bill.
You do, Madam Chairs and Senator Johnson, I wouldn't mind having you have that option myself.
Thank you.
The list continues to get longer.
Senator Gary George.
My assumption when we see the numbers going like this is that you really want to reach a point which would require review by the legislature to say, okay, that's about it. Because I think the bigger that pot gets, the bigger the temptation for this bunch to take it. And so my idea of coming back and reviewing this every now and then is at some point we may say, okay, we've updated all the systems, we're doing great, let's moderate this fund, we always have to do replacement, but make sure that it doesn't grow too big just because of the political temptation. I know you may not want to comment on that, but I'm just saying that's my opinion of why we might want to review this.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair,
for your testimony. Oh, I'm sorry. Just 1 minute.
I apologize for missing. Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I missed the earlier committee hearing. Can I ask one quick question?
Sure. Absolutely.
As I look at this, my first gut reaction is that there's a large number of cell phones being purchased all the time, and more families are getting more lines. And I'm guessing this fund is growing very, very rapidly, which is why we were able to raid, why the legislature was able to raid that. When you project in the future, are we going to see a continual growth in the number of lines? Are we going to see that growth in this particular fund continue to go up beyond what is needed by the 911 service?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator George, I'm not in a position to have enough data to tell you the answer to either parts of those questions, I think. If that's something that you'd like us to look at, I'd be happy to take that on.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to call Mary Bodkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we represent all those wonderful people at the other end of the 911 call. And I'm not sure what this says about Jenny and I and our time in the building, but it was, I think it was my third session that Gary Wilhelm, Jenny Lang, and I sat down and put together the original fee for line charges to fund our 911 system. And our theory at the time was that we wanted to expand 911. We wanted to make it better. And we were just moving into the enhanced systems. And the enhanced system is the system that when you pick up your phone and dial 911, the call taker can see your phone, your address. And as we expanded that system and as we improved it, we have continued this tax as a way to fund, more appropriately fund the 911 system with the idea that it didn't matter where you lived or what you did, everybody in the state of Oregon should have access to an enhanced 911 system. And as the technology has changed, we have utilized those funds to expand the system and to stay up with technology. And so now, as you know, we can find you even with a cell phone. And we are in favor of this bill. We would prefer it without the sunset, because we know what this money goes for. It helps pay for the call takers and the training. And, you know, every 911 dispatch center in Oregon is understaffed. And it's understaffed because most of us can't do that work. And so we need to be able to identify folks who have the ability to multitask, take tremendous stress and trauma, and continue to pick up the phone. Because, you know, our folks don't have the option of sort of stepping away and saying, I'm going to take a few hours off now. And that is something that we think is really important. Now, if we can't get this bill any other way than with the sunset, we'll take it with the sunset, but we'd prefer it without. And most of you know that already. But we'll take it any way we can get it because we think it's really, really important that as we expand and improve communications, and I don't know what the next innovative communication system looks like. I don't know that. And I bet most of you don't know that. But we need to have the ability to properly fund the system to keep up with that technology. And we'd appreciate your support on this bill. And if somebody was just moved to get rid of the sunset, we'd be delighted.
any questions of Ms. Bodkin? Thank you very much for your testimony today.
I would just like to thank you and your employees, the dispatchers in this state, who do a fabulous job. Thank you.
You know what? I think these are, you know, if there are truly angels at the other end of the line, it is these men and women who do this incredible work. That's just true. Incredible work that they do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Actually, committee, I would be willing to move the bill today because everybody agrees, but we're going to go on a trip on February the 23rd, and we're going to be in a new 911 center. And Representative Boone has asked that we actually work session this bill and pass it in the 911 center, and it's very symbolic, and I think that's very good. So accommodating that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2369. Committee, we need to suspend the rules to allow Representative Shoffler to vote on House Bill 2370. Are there any objections? All right. Hearing none. Mr. Assistant over there.
Senator George L.
We'll just Representative Shoffler.
Shoffler.
We suspended the rule.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for indulging me. I wasn't awake when we were ready to vote, so I had to get some coffee. I vote aye. Thank you very much.
All right. Now we have an informational meeting, and I'll invite those with the Civil Air Patrol to come forward and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If you'll identify yourself for the record.
I'll be happy to. I'm Colonel Ted Kyle. I'm the commander for Civil Air Patrol for Oregon. I'm a resident of West Lynn. And we're here to talk to you today a little bit about what Civil Air Patrol is, what we do for the citizens of Oregon. We'll also talk to you a little bit about what we've done nationwide recently. And we're here to ask you a question. And we'll leave that for the end. We have a short presentation we'd like to present that will kind of give you a quick tour of what Civil Air Patrol is. So to start with, one thing you should know is that we're all aviators that are interested in flying for a purpose, and that purpose is to save lives and serve our community. We all get paid the same in Civil Air Patrol, nothing. And we're pretty proud of that. With me today, I have Major Dave Rudowitz beside me.
Excuse me, that's similar to us.
Yes, I think so. And I know all of us do various kinds of things in our communities for different reasons. We have over 700 members in Oregon, and each one of them comes with a different reason of why they do it. I know why I do it. I think we all gain something. I think the community does as well. With me is Major Dave Rudowitz. Dave is our Emergency Services Director, and he'll be giving you some of the more details about some of the things that we do. Civil Air Patrol was formed on December the 1st, 1941. And I'm sure all of you remember from the history books like I do what happened on December the 7th. We were formed with one key purpose in mind, and that was that civilian aviators were getting together. They knew that World War II was coming soon, and they knew that the likelihood is when war broke out, they might lose their right to fly, and they wanted to support the war effort. Well, when we think about that, and we remember what happened on September 11th, and I know a number of you have already talked about this in this room today, what happened on September 11th? We were savagely attacked. All of the aviators were grounded that day, and in fact, shortly thereafter, for the next 2 weeks, there was only two organizations in the United States who were allowed to fly airplanes. They were the United States Air Force. They were flying jets with missiles on their wings, and the Civil Air Patrol. Why was the Civil Air Patrol allowed to fly when nobody else was? Well, it's kind of a simple reason. One is you can't do much damage with a Cessna 182. That's one of them. The other reason is that there was a crying need. We were the only organization allowed to provide any transport, and at that point there were people all over the country, and including here in Oregon, that were giving a tremendous amount of blood to the Red Cross. All of that blood would have been discarded had we not had the ability to move those samples to the testing lab. The testing lab for the West Coast is in San Diego. Members from Oregon gathered up those samples, put them in our little airplane, stripped the seats out, the carpet, everything else they could to reduce the weight of the aircraft to carry as many as we could to Oakland. At that point, California wing members took it the rest of the way to San Diego. Had we not been there, who knows what would have happened. You want to go on to the next slide there? Our members also were responsible, because we were only people flying airplanes, to take the first aerial pictures of New York City, and this is one of them. 2 weeks later, finally, everyone else finally got back in the air. So that's a little bit of our history. I'm very proud of our organization. And you want to go on to the next slide here? Katrina was a big deal for us. We activated across the country 15 wings. That means members from 15 states came together to help out along the Gulf Coast. Incredible disaster. For instance, a lot of people were affected in New Orleans. The Mississippi headquarters for Civil Air Patrol was absolutely wiped out. But yet we responded, and you can see here's one of our members, and there's the camp, and we were the first contact for over 8,900 people on the ground in parts of Mississippi.
All
of us, again, just donating our time. We donated 14,000 person hours of effort. We brought together people from all over the country. We did over 1,000 hours flying airplanes in support of the Air Force, in support of local and state agencies in both Louisiana and Mississippi. It stretched us to a degree that was unimaginable in that time. So thinking about Oregon and Pacific Coast, the Pacific region of Civil Air Patrol, which includes Oregon, Washington, California, Alaska, Hawaii, and Nevada, is putting together an exercise, and we're going to practice a major tsunami affecting the entire West Coast.
Okay.
Well, the National Commander has made that now a nationwide mission, and they're going to activate the alerting process and get prepared to bring in services here to the Pacific Northwest, to the Pacific Coast, from across the country. Now, we're not actually going to deploy those people, but one of the goals in this exercise is to see if we can survey and photograph the entire Pacific Coast in a reasonable length of time. Emergency managers, I know, will be excited about that service. So, Major Rudowitz, you want to take over and walk through the
Major David program. Rudowitz, I'm Director of Emergency Services for Oregon Wing. I'm going to back up one slide here. What I wanted to talk about today were the kinds of services we can provide to the state of Oregon and the citizens of Oregon. In the case of disaster relief, those services include reconnaissance, digital photography, airborne communications, and transportation of various kinds of critical resources. And we'll talk a little bit more about these as we go through the presentation. We also are very active in search and rescue, looking for missing aircraft primarily, also hikers, vehicles, walkaways, and so forth, working through the Office of Emergency Management here in Oregon. And also includes looking for electronic beacons such as the PRBs that you've probably heard about with regard to hikers. And in the material that we've left with the assistant for the committee, I've prepared some material on PRBs in case you have any interest or anything comes up on that. Well, primarily these are emergency locator transmitters that are found on aircraft. We also can provide support in a command post for search and rescue to augment the emergency management team, and we have some other capabilities as well. In addition, in our emergency services area, we provide support to the Coast Guard. We are very involved in a counter-drug program where we work with a number of the agencies involved in drug trafficking and preventing that. We get involved with the Western Area Defense Sector for intercept missions where we simulate targets, and they try to slow down and catch us. We'll show you a picture of that a little later. We've been involved with live organ transports and also vital medicines. We saved a girl in Medford a couple years ago who needed a medicine very quickly from OHSU, and within about 3 hours we had it picked up and delivered to her at the hospital.
That was a brand newborn baby, had a very rare disease.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we support the Red Cross, also the Customs and other agencies now that come under the Department of Homeland Security. Having trouble keeping track of who reports to who these days. Just a few statistics related to our emergency services. Last year we had 48 search and rescue missions, 2 Homeland Security missions, which were target missions, and we did 7 funded training exercises. You can see that our costs, or the costs that were reimbursed by the Air Force, so about $10,000 for search and rescue and about $44,000 for training. And this does not include any of the expenses incurred by members that are not reimbursed. So their food, their equipment, their lodging is all on their expense.
That's about 1 a week, and I can tell you the guys who call them out delight in waking me up. And they've done it many times.
I took him out on one so that he would get to see what it was like.
Yeah.
In Oregon, we have between 600 and 700 members. It moves around every month or so. We have about 300 that are emergency services qualified. We have 17 squadrons around the state, 6 aircraft, 20 vehicles that include 8 4x4s and 10 vans, and we have some portable generators. These are a couple pictures of our aircraft. We have 5 Cessna 182s. Those are and 1 Cessna 172. They're all 4-seat aircraft. We typically only fly them with 3 to give us a margin of safety in mountain flying so that we have enough horsepower to handle any kind of situation that might come up. Right now, our aircraft are positioned around the state at Bend, Brookings, Eugene, Hillsboro, Medford, and Troutdale. The positioning has a lot to do with where incidents might occur that we need the aircraft, where we have facilities where they can be housed and taken care of, and where we have members that can fly them. We also have an organized communications network. We have 9 mountaintop repeaters here in Oregon. We also have high-frequency radio. That's the old long antenna stuff, if any of you are amateur radio operators. We operate on Air Force-assigned frequencies. We're not controlled by the Federal Communications Commission, but by the same agency that controls all federal government communications. Our VHF radio system will be capable of digital and scramble, so we can encrypt our communications. We have aircraft, mobile, and handheld radios, and we operate in the 136 to 174 megahertz band, which basically is similar to state police and fire here in Oregon. We're going through an upgrade in our radio system now. The Air Force decided we needed to comply with Department of Defense requirements to meet the new technology standards, and luckily they decided to fund that change. So we're going through a complete refurbishment of our equipment. It had been primarily member furnished, and now it's going to be primarily government furnished. We're looking forward to that. It's helped us quite a bit. As was mentioned by Colonel Kyle, Civil Air Patrol is a nationwide organization, over 55,000 members. Well, there's 8 regions, Pacific region being, from a landmass perspective, one of the largest, if not, I guess, the largest, because we have Alaska in there. It kind of takes up for everything. And we have a lot of challenges in the region because of location and the widespreadness of our wings. Civil Air Patrol is the largest Cessna owner in the world and literally the 3rd largest Air Force.
That's what I've heard.
With 535 aircraft and over 815 vehicles.
No weapons.
No. During World War II, we sunk a couple of submarines, but they don't let us do that anymore. So. And all of these resources are available to Oregon or any other agency that had a need. If it was big enough, we just keep requesting till we run out. So, as I mentioned earlier, with the number of services we have available here in Oregon, I'm going to talk about each of these things, these services here, just a little bit. In the case of reconnaissance, damage assessment and route reconnaissance, looking to see where damage has occurred, where it's difficult to get in on the ground or impossible to do that, we can use our own observers. We can fly observers from an agency or organization. We have the capability of providing real-time communication to the ground on our VHF frequencies, and we're looking to develop more capability with satellite telephones. We have one aircraft that's equipped with that now, and we're hoping to be able to expand capabilities in that area. But basically, we can relay from any of our aircraft pretty much anywhere in Oregon back to the ground and get into a telephone system or otherwise back where the information is needed. We can perform digital high-resolution photography. The upper picture you see here, actually, we didn't shoot. Civil Air Patrol did, and it's a flooded shopping center as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And if we were to blow that up, you can see quite a bit of detail in those pictures. The lower picture is a dam in, I believe, in Multnomah County. It was shot on one of our training exercises by one of our air crews. We can transmit photos from the aircraft in near real time. That means we take the picture and then can email it or otherwise post it through the Internet and get it back to an agency on the ground who wants to see that image right away. So it's not movies. It's not like Channel 8 or 6, whichever one has the helicopter. But we can provide these photos. They are high resolution. We've done, within the organization, supported activities such as the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake, where they actually discovered some folks doing something they shouldn't have been as part of the surveillance we were doing with the military. They photographed those folks, sent that back, and I believe the FBI decided they warranted a visit and went out there and arrested them. Some of the photos that we've been able to take in some of our testing, there's a little ferry up in Astoria. The guy's meeting all the FAA regulations for separation from the ground, and that you could identify the men and women sign on the bathrooms sitting on the on that ferry.
This service is new in Oregon, and it's one that's now deployed across the country. The key thing is an emergency manager can request a picture of a target or facility or whatever they need a picture of, and we can get it to them as fast as we can get an airplane there, take the picture, and email it. This is a new thing. We haven't been able to do that before. And in Katrina, it was used to a huge amount because they could get information in a way they could never do it before.
As I mentioned earlier, for communications, we can provide radio relay for ourselves or for other agencies in areas that do not have radio coverage for one reason or another, either due to a disaster or just due to the fact they don't have coverage there. We can use our own operators. We can fly an agency operator. When we do counter-drug operations, for example, we'll bring someone from that agency. They usually bring one of their radios along, although with our newer radio equipment we're getting now, many cases we can program in an agency's frequency and use that directly. This is in addition to the aircraft radios in there.
Senator Fuhrer?
Is that a land-based or are you using the aircraft as a relay point?
We're using the aircraft as a relay. We're supposed to be getting a couple of airborne repeaters this year that were purchased out of this upgrade. We're not sure yet if they're going to be frequency agile that we can adjust. We're hoping they are, in which case we could do even more innovative things by providing the relay and not having to have a person in the loop to take down the message and then repeat it.
Follow-up.
This is off of the electronics and back to the aircraft. 535 aircraft. How many of those are within hours of Oregon? Any part of the Oregon coast, for example? We have probably a bunch in California and in Washington and quite a few in Alaska.
And that's correct. In the Boise, Idaho, yeah, they cover Idaho. A lot of the eastern part of Oregon for us for search and rescue because they're right there. So those are available, I think.
Nevada.
Primarily 182s or similar aircraft, you will say?
Nearly all.
Okay, I think most
and
of
Washington
you
are, State also.
Most mm-hmm. of you are familiar with that aircraft. One of the thoughts on the coast is how do you get things there, medicine mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. 182, yeah, I could land it out here on the street, so could these guys. Probably do a better job than I could today.
Problem.
But anyway, it's a wonderful aircraft, and this is the news, I think, that Brian Boquist and I were waiting for. We thought that this might be coming, this technology and stuff. This is a real jump forward, you guys, so this is wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, I might also mention we've been focusing on our what we call corporate assets, but our members also often bring their own aircraft, and that gives us a wider spectrum of aircraft types available that can be used. We've got a group down in Brookings that's looking to try to get funding donated to purchase a twin-engine aircraft to use. So, and we have I guess at least one other member, I believe, that has a twin. And as I mentioned, Washington State has resources that are immediately available to us as well. There's an aircraft right there in Vancouver.
I think they have 11 airplanes in Washington. The neat part is we're getting to where we can operate at the region level now, and we're practicing at that level now. And as we move forward, we're starting to operate beyond the region level so that we can bring people in from Utah, from Montana, from Idaho, and as far east as we need to. You know, those little airplanes actually get around fairly quickly.
Senator Morissette?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have pontoon planes?
We do in Alaska. We don't in very many other places. We don't in Oregon.
Okay.
All right, continue, please.
Thank you. I would like to also mention we're doing some experimentation with airborne public address systems specifically for things like evacuation management for tsunamis. I think we have the equipment now. It's being installed. We're not sure how we're going to be able to buy it, but at least we're going to test it and make sure it can work, including we're going to be looking at the Kim search scenario of flying over in IFR conditions to see if legally, based on the FAA regulations, an aircraft that's flying in an area like that could be heard on the ground, so that you could signal to somebody, turn your cell phone on, or we're looking for you, you know, start a fire or something like that.
We're working with Hawaii Wing on that. They do a lot of tsunami surveys there, and they're very well practiced at it.
We also provide support to the Oregon Air National Guard, where we simulate terrorist targets. You want to come up here? Lieutenant Bill Kostich is my project officer for the support to the Guard. Do you want to tell them just briefly what we've been doing?
If you'll identify yourself for the record,
ma'am.
Please.
My name is Lieutenant Bill Kostich. I am an emergency services officer in the 085 Squadron for the Oregon Wing. My primary duty with the Air National Guard is I set up these Air Force intercept missions whereby we portray a terrorist scenario or someone who is entering into a temporary flight-restricted airspace, and the F-15s then will attempt to intercept us at slow speed. You can see in this picture, this F-15 is at about a 20-degree angle, which is one of the methods that a high-performance jet needs to perform to slow down to reach a speed of about 120 knots. That's not something jets are quite comfortable with. Some other pictures, they'll actually have their landing gear out or their air brakes up at 10,000 feet. It's quite extraordinary.
I think in one case they had the tail hook down also.
Anything they can do to induce some drag so that they can slow down. So what they'll do is they'll come along, they'll identify the aircraft, they'll make an attempt to communicate with us through an ICAO signal such as a wing rock. If there's no response, then they give the order, depending on who's responsible to do so, to make a quartering gun run and possibly shoot the airplane down. I took this picture myself, and I can tell you, if I was a private pilot and saw this outside my window, I'd pay attention.
Yeah. Trust me, you were awake.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Years ago, I visited Camp Adair when it used to be a facility that would... They had two big computers that would fill this room. Those were the old computers. The job was to track any airplane coming toward the shore without a flight plan. And the plan was, if they saw something that they couldn't identify, they radioed Portland and they had one of those out there within minutes. Is that still part of the plan, or have things changed? We're not...
Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Senator, we just, the week before last, had a simulation that sort of describes what you are talking about, in that an airplane took off out of Hillsborough, and this was not simulated. I mean, we actually performed the flight. It was reported stolen with some suspicious activity. In this case, they were loading the plane with what appeared to be some fertilizer and some small gas cans. And there was a note left in the hangar from which the aircraft was stolen that this gentleman supposedly had a vendetta against the Oregon Duck Football organization and had intended to seek some revenge. So... What we did was the airplane got into position. The fighters did not know that this was an exercise. So we coordinated, it was through WADS, the Western Air Defense Sector, which is out of McCord Air Force Base. It was coordinated through the FAA, Seattle Center, and the various FBOs, that as soon as this airplane launched, the FBO at Hillsborough made the appropriate contact and went through the FAA, went through WADS, then went all the way to Pang. The aircraft was, the two airplanes were launched with full armament, and the airplane was intercepted and forced to land. So to answer your question a little more specifically, you don't have to have a flight plan to fly an airplane. But if there is some suspicious activity, it was a matter literally of moments before this plane was intercepted by
fighters. Madam Chair,
by fighters.
Me?
Yes.
Gentlemen, how do you get anybody to volunteer for that?
Since I choose the flight crews, I have a very, very short list that I use for that.
Yeah, God bless.
No, the order to shoot down a civilian airplane, obviously, is one that goes, I think, to the highest levels of government. So once the aircrafts were launched, it was made aware to them that this was an exercise. Okay. And armament was not an issue.
Were you on board?
I was not on board.
We also, with regard to radar approaches or below radar approaches to the coast, we will assist WADS when they want to test out and look for holes in the radar. And we also do that sometimes when there's a missing aircraft, mm-hmm. to try to figure out where they might have been if they dropped off radar or weren't seen in somewhere that it was expected they should have been in the course of their flight. Which sometimes turns up problems with the radar system.
Madam Chair, may I just follow?
Sure.
We, in our tour, this was 50 years ago. It's amazing the changes, but we were watching the screens when the operators were looking at for those. And yeah, the radar was the big thing. Anything that they could see approaching that was avoiding the radar or whatever. So it's. The walls were 5 feet thick in that particular building. It's probably still there. It's now a city, but that facility is probably still there.
Pretty amazing.
Senator George.
One of the biggest concerns that I've had for years has been that a terrorist would decide to take a small aircraft, load it with road flares, fly over our force, and light them and throw them out. And my thought is this is probably our best chance to intercept that aircraft. As soon as we got a report of fire, if you saw multiples, you'd probably start thinking that way. You would try to anticipate where that was going to be, and so I would imagine within a short amount of time we could intercept.
Well, I'd like to tell you that after our original intercept exercises, our National Operations Center as well as the Air National Guard was pleased enough that we do these now on a monthly basis.
Wonderful.
The training.
They can get pretty much anywhere in the state within, a few minutes. It's uncanny.
Is this out of McCord or is it out of the Portland Air Base?
WADS is conducted out of Western Air Defense Sector. SIR is conducted out of McCord. And the PANG, of course, is out of the Portland Air Base.
Oh, okay.
Just one quick follow-up.
Okay.
Doppler, can you pick them up flying low over the forest?
Can we pick whom?
Could you pick up a low-flying aircraft over the over the forest?
With our
using Doppler or whatever systems we would have. Once that you were alerted.
Right. The F-15s use Doppler. Okay. Our Cessnas do not use Doppler.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
But F-15s do have a Doppler capability.
We're just the targets.
I want you to find this buggy, though.
Okay.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
We mentioned earlier about critical transport and transporting critical items by air. Obviously, we have limited capacity, but we can respond pretty quickly to those kind of requests in an emergency. We can also, with regard to logistics, logistical support, provide route reconnaissance and overwatch on like transport of a critical item. We can provide air cover for those things. And, in fact, that is done by some wings on the East Coast, for example, movement of nuclear munitions and other items, using the photography capability and the radio relay and so forth. And also they monitor, with a couple different Coast Guard districts on the East Coast, ships coming in to identify them visually at a distance to make sure they're who they are and where they're supposed to be. Air search and rescue is a big area for us, as I mentioned earlier, looking for missing aircraft, primarily the beacons, when they work and when they don't work. For example, that photo in the lower portion of the screen is a plane that crashed a couple years ago on Three Finger Jack, and that was found the hard way by visual searching. Another day, and that aircraft would have been obscured by snow and would not have been found for perhaps several months. We will also assist with missing and lost persons, including rafters and hikers and so forth. All of this at the request of the State Office of Emergency Management.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Mills. Thank you. I want to just thank you, gentlemen, for all you do. And coming from my aviation background of Evergreen, I know how wonderful you are. And we've been blessed to have Les Peterson and so many great commanders there. Just thank you. I'm just wondering, do you have FLIR?
No, we don't.
Okay. Could, excuse me, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Could you use it if we could?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
And it would be, there's no charge for our flying on these search and rescue missions to anybody but the federal government. So the crews are doing as volunteers, and the fuel, maintenance, and oil for the aircraft is paid for out of an Air Force budget. Very small Air Force budget. But ground search and rescue support primarily associated with looking for missing aircraft. We also have provided support for looking for missing persons as well. And it's both visual as well as the using emergency locating equipment to track the beacons when they're out. We can provide assistance on the emergency management teams for running a large operation. That can include the Air Branch, where we are have significant expertise, but we have a number of folks that have had a lot of training, a number of very highly trained and experienced incident commanders who can come in and fill a number of positions to augment an emergency management team for a sheriff, for example, if they have a large operation and they need assistance.
Excuse me, may I? Yes, follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Strange, I've never had to ask this question before, but who can call you up? The local, just like a Life Flight or any
other?
Well,
for search, for search and rescue, the local sheriff is a responsible official. They would go to the State Office of Emergency Management, say, I'd like Civil Air Patrol. They make a phone call, and in about 5 minutes, we're back on the phone with the sheriff and can start our response.
So the sheriff in every county is
yes.
the key contact.
Thank
you.
For that.
Sure.
Chair, sorry.
Yeah, except for the ELTs, that's handled by an AFRCC satellite. That we're contacted then by the AFRCC.
Well, actually, it goes through OEM though. We just have first call when it when it's not when a county that let me back up. The emergency locator beacons are picked up by a satellite system, and that information is fed to the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center in Langley, Virginia. If it's determined to be on land, if it's determined to be on the ocean, it goes to the Coast Guard, and when it's like in near the coast, they fight over it sometimes. Whoever doesn't want to do it gives it to the other agency. So in Oregon, because of the sheriff's responsibility is designated by the statutes, some sheriffs have elected to be what they call first call on emergency locator transmitters. So if the position is indicated in their county, they take responsibility. And, for example, Lane County is first call. They take all of those there, and we will assist them if requested. The other counties that are not first call, Office of Emergency Management will call Civil Air Patrol to be the first response on that, and we're supporting the Office of Emergency Management in that case. Then, depending on what we find, it may get turned over to the local sheriff, or we just may go ahead and handle the whole thing. If there's a missing aircraft, typically those are not well identified as to where that is, and so we're usually the first responsible agency in the state for a mission like that. Then if we can narrow it down to a particular county, and we're really sure it's there and we haven't already found it, that local sheriff can assume command of that. For example, in the, using the Kim search, had they been in an aircraft, we would have been responsible for that search.
Sir, about how much longer are you? Is your presentation?
I'm just about done.
About done? All right.
Just a little bit on costs that we were mentioning. As you can see here, we're about $110 an hour, and as you go up the scale of different kinds of aircraft, all of the other ones, that's only the aircraft operation and fuel, not the crews. And so we're you can get 40 hours of Civil Air Patrol support for 1 hour of a C-130.
That's a person week.
And just basically to sum up, Oregon Wing Civil Air Patrol is made of dedicated, skilled, equipped, and trained unpaid professionals. We're a nationwide organization with resources in depth. We have our own transport. We come when invited, and we bring funding. So
I'll tell you, that's not a bad ending.
just a final word, and then we'll be done. I think the key thing is we're volunteer aviators. We bring our skills to service of the country and the state. We bring the power of a nationwide organization. We bring the training and oversight of the United States Air Force, one of the premier flying organizations in the world, I think. So the question I have for you, it's not really a question, it's a request. Keep us in mind as you craft policy for emergency response in Oregon. Mm-hmm. We're a bargain. We're not just a flying club. We really do train and know what we're doing.
Madam Chair,
I couldn't agree with the Colonel more, and I just want to say hello to the Colonel, because last time I saw him several years ago, you were with the Clackamas County Sewer.
I still am.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say
that's
hello
my day job.
It's been
like
a long time since
you.
I've seen you.
Day job.
So welcome to the Capitol, and thanks for all the work you do.
All right, thank you very much for this information today. I think it was well received by the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening.
All right, committee, we have just a little bit of housekeeping here to do. We have a list here that I'm going to give to Representative Boone. She has graciously offered to arrange to have lunches prepared for us on our February the 23rd trip. Looks like we're going to have a nice group. Now, the next trip is March the 2nd. Be sure to get it on your schedule. That's a Friday. We're going to Lincoln City. There will be an event in Lincoln City. There is a grand opening of the fourth floor of City Hall, and they are prepared to hold our meeting in City Hall. It will start at 1 o'clock. We'll finish the meeting 10 minutes before 3. Go upstairs, and they are very excited because they will have all of us involved in their ribbon cutting for the fourth floor.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
That's the new Culinary Institute that they're cutting the ribbon for.
Okay, is that what it is?
It's located on the fourth floor, and it's a new
Culinary
Institute.
It was an event on the fourth floor. Thank you, Representative Cowan, for that. So that's great. Their new Culinary Institute. So perhaps they will try out some of their goodies. Who knows?
Can only hope.
But anyway, you will be getting an agenda. Just be sure you get March the 2nd on your calendar, and if there's no other business.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
To be sure that everyone knows, your good administrator has told us that we will be meeting on February the 16th.
Yes, ma'am, 3 o'clock.
At 3 o'clock to work on our task force regarding a change in the Constitution.
The Constitution, HJR 6.
At 3 o'clock in room 446?
Yes.
So I just want everybody to know that. And then on the 23rd, is that an all day?
It's in the middle, 446.
Yes.
The February 23rd, is that an early 8 a.m.?
That's a Friday.
We were planning to start at 10 o'clock in the morning and then end no later than 2.
10 o'clock where?
In Lincoln City.
No, we're talking
about
the 23rd. Okay. So
I will be sending out all the information. We have an opportunity that if you would like transport over to Tillamook and back, we can provide that, or you can take your own vehicles, whatever you like. I'll be sending out an email with a MapQuest, so you can let me know what your desire would be.
Thank you.
So that we should count on that being an all-day event on the 23rd?
Yes.
I mean, you'll start approximately 10 o'clock.
Yes.
And
10 o'clock and end at 2 in Tillamook. So
just trying to get some calendar
straight. Right, exactly.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Director Murphy, you're always invited and welcome, so if you'd like to head to the coast, join us there.
All right. If there's nothing else for the good of the order, I'll call the meeting adjourned.